Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of At the Devil's Ball, the podcast where we talk about horror and genre films in a positive and constructive manner. I am Nathaniel.
And I am Samuel.
And this week we are joined by an old friend from Movieocrity, the now defunct Movieocrity. Are you still bringing that back?
It's on. We'll call it on hiatus. It's been defunct for a while. Right. But now I'm saying hiatus because it's an extended hiatus because of last years of craziness, whichever everybody I think can relate to.
Yeah.
I have some ideas on ways in which to bring it back. So hopefully get that going soon, but nothing concrete yet.
Right.
Okay. Well, it's Scott Davis with us of Movieocrity, the on hiatus Movieocrity. And this week we're talking The Changeling, the third entry into our Haunted House month. Sam's got the vitals and we'll just jump into this.
All right. The Changeling was released on March 28th, 1980, directed by Peter Medak, written by Russell Hunter and William Gray. Excuse me. I came out of nowhere. I'm sorry. Starring George C. Scott, Trish Van Devere, Melvin Douglas, Gene Marsh, John Colicos, Barry Morse, Madeline Sherwood, Helen Burns, Frances Hyland, Ruth Springford, and Eric Christmas. That's it for our main cast, I believe. Nathaniel, you picked this one, so why don't you start off with why you chose this one particularly? Sure.
Well, obviously, I mean, I still think it's probably one of the greatest Haunted House movies ever made. I've always loved it. I was visiting a friend in college when he was in college. I think I was like 17, 18. His roommate, it was like his favorite movie. And so we watched it and, I was really, really, just really got into it. And, but yeah, I mean, I think it's a phenomenal film. And so that's sort of why when we was thinking about Haunted House movies, it was an obvious selection.
Right on.
As far as where to start with it, I'm not certain. Probably with, generally speaking, Scott, when we mentioned you were going to come on and do Eyes Wide Shut, and then we had to shut that down due to various circumstances. When we mentioned to you and another guest we were going to have on for that we were doing Haunted House movies and that Changeling was on the list, you jumped on The Changeling. So what made you jump on for The Changeling in particular?
Next to Robert Wise's The Haunting, I think The Changeling is just the best ghost story I've ever seen filmed. It's just a fantastic movie. I've seen it a bunch of times, and so it's always a pleasure to revisit it. I love George C. Scott's performance, and I love how it uses one character's grief to propel the story forward as we get deeper and deeper into this mystery.
For sure. Yeah. Sam, you've seen this before.
Yes.
Yeah. So what are your general, why don't we just start with that? What's our general takeaways on this movie? How many times have you seen it and what does it, you know, generally mean to you?
Right. I've seen it, I don't know, several times over the years. I agree that it's probably one of the best, you know, Haunted House movies ever made. Pardon me. Got a frog in my throat today.
I get that, me too.
Yeah.
It's the cold weather.
Yeah, I was outside shoveling some before. It was like 15 degrees out there. So it's
cold. It's really cold. It's 15 degrees here in St. Louis too. Yeah.
Right. It's no fun.
No.
But I'm in Minnesota.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so you gotta speak. Yeah. But anyways, where was I? How I like the movie. It's just a fascinating film, and it's unlike a lot of other Haunted House movies, because most, like a lot of Haunted House movies, you have a group of people either investigating a house, or you have like a family moving into the house. And here it's just one guy, and he's going through, you know, his trauma, his grief, and, you know, coming apart at the seams, while all this is happening. And so it's a different take on that, and I appreciate that it's, you know, not the standard, you know, okay, here's five guys investigating a haunted house, or like I said, a family trying to live together in, you know, in this kind of situation.
Yeah, I mean, come to think of it, you know, as personal as the ghost story usually is, in literature particularly, most ghost stories are usually, I think it was it's like in the annals of Gothic literature, like the most like one of the most famous ghost stories is Last Man on Earth is alone in his room, suddenly a knock on the door. You know, just two sentences. And it's like the scariest concept ever. But that the haunted house movie is usually kind of the haunted story is supposed to more be about a personal connection. And it is interesting that most media tends to go with groups in haunted house fiction. Both our films we've done this month were groups. Scott mentioned The Haunting, that's a group. We did Legend of Hell House at the end of December. That's a group. Why do we think that is? Do we think it's just because it's just screenwriting and we have to have characters, or you know? But the Changeling is somewhat unique in the sense that it is one guy living it alone in a crumbly old mansion. Well, actually, a very well-appointed and nice mansion, I should say. But having this sort of personal haunting that connects to his own emotional and psychological state. Why do we think that the haunted house story in media tends to go towards like families or groups? Do we have any theories on that? Like what do you guys think?
I think that two possible things. One, because you mentioned families at the end. Now that of course touches into something that not everybody, I mean, I'm single, but that a lot of people can relate to. So you have things like poltergeist. Well, what was so terrifying about, well, I mean, it was a little girl was taken, you know, and it showed how this family broke apart, you know, and Amityville Horror, similar thing there. And I think that whenever you would put a family in something, that always hits a personal note, which I'll come back to in just a second. But I think usually it is screenwriting. They say, okay, we should have somebody to represent skepticism. We should have somebody, and there's usually also somebody who's very traumatized and everything like that. You take, like, say, like the drunk character. Oh God, character actor's name, I can't remember. You know him from House of Haunted Hill. You know, those characters, they always seem to have like lots. There's somebody that's you m might be using greed as a motivating factor. So they try to like put all of these people in and show how they're no match for it, and that they're all fooled because haha, you can't, you know, whatever the spirits are or whatever. That is typically what they do. Now, the great thing about this is that it does focus on a family, but a family that was interrupted because our main character is mourning after losing his wife and child in a horrifying accident that he witnessed. And so even though he, and so he's in the house, he's all alone, he's saying, but he's still carrying this with him. I mean, how could you not? I mean, how could you not just replay that in your head a million times a day? And and so he's still very fresh from this grief, this trauma, and this loss, and he's carrying it in the house with him. And I think that it's that grief and loss that actually does motivate the character, so that even though the wife and child are now absent, they are still present because they're they might not be present in like the spectral form, but their spirits are still kind of presence in his life as he holds them close to him still. And I think that's why he becomes such a conduit for the to solve the mysteries of this of the characters and of the mystery at the center of the changeling.
Yeah, for sure. And then you've got the added connection of I think you're absolutely right that the idea of that family's present, but he's also building a new unusual one where he kind of has a new girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of developing that relationship. But he also kind of has a new child in the sense of this ghost that
right.
is a child ghost, although kind of dead yeah. as a child. You have this idea of, I think at the heart of the changeling is this concept of holding on to the past, doesn't really go anywhere. Like you can't, the ghost's entire point is that someone replaced me, and has lived this, you know, extraordinary life, and that upsets me. There's no justice. But also at the same time, it's destructive. Like there's no moving on for Joseph
right.
until this justice is done. And of course, the most famous scene in the Changeling is he makes the John makes the attempt to move on, and the ghost won't let him. You know, the ghost reminds him that no, you're not done yet. That ball scene is one of the greatest. If not the greatest ghost story moment in cinema history, in my opinion. But yeah, you have that notion of the present family. It's just unorthodox. But he's so yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, there is still a family involved, but it's not. I guess when it comes to the haunted house story, the domestic aspect of the house has to be addressed.
Right.
In this case, also the house itself as a character in The Changeling is more impersonal, versus the home of the family. It's an interesting mentality of how much John inhabits this house, which isn't much. You know, he's in there, but he's not, it's not a home. He's not,
right.
You know,
it's this very, for one person, it's basically probably because he's this respected artist, composer in the movie, that it's this one person and it's a very large house. I mean,
yeah.
Even from, though it goes back to like the early 1900s, 1800s, whatever, it's this huge house with all this empty space, and he's this one solitary figure in the middle of it, and he's kind of at the mercy of the force that's in it. It's because it's not the house that's, you know, it's not the house, it's the person, you know,
right.
it's the figure, you know, and what we of course figure out eventually that it is not simply connected to the house at all.
Right.
That just happens to be where they
yeah.
are.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting to me too that it's one of the things I've thought about with this movie is for a movie that explains an awful lot at length. I mean, this movie is a movie that actually includes a going to visit the Hall of Records and getting a real estate history. And yet somehow
a
it's not boring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Microfiche scenes and, it still never has anybody come out and say why John,
right?
Why this connection between Joseph and John exists. We understand it as an audience, but it's because he's a grieving father that
right.
Joseph's able to be like, you know, as a dead kid, you and I have an understanding, but also just that I can, you know, that Joseph can feel that he was a good father, that he cared about his child versus Joseph's own father. Who is a special kind of monster.
Right.
And so, but you know, there's even a medium in this movie and the medium doesn't, like, you know, I feel like a movie made in 2024 that had the medium would be like, it's because of you, John, and because you are a
right.
grieving
they
father.
Would over-explain it. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, it's actually Guillermo del Toro, I think, just said like a couple days ago, he did some sort of video I don't remember exactly how he put it, but basically saying like one of the modern problems with modern cinema is studios forcing filmmakers to explain things that maybe the art itself wouldn't go to that effort.
Right.
And so, I mean, I do feel like there would have been more to connect that. But I think it's just a kind of amazing that this is sort of the one thing they don't explain in The Changeling. Like, there are long sequences of two characters comparing notes about what's happened and why and where we're going. But there's never a moment of, other than John kind of casually saying, is it because of that? Is it because I'm a grieving father? Is that why this is happening? Nobody ever comes out and says it. And that's really fascinating to me.
You know, I would just, when you said that, it reminded me of this quote. I'm only bringing this up because I remember somebody when I, decades ago, when I used to post on the alt horror Usenet forums there, somebody used that you would sign their posts with this. And it was, I believe, a quote from, I think it was Dario Argento, who said, we don't solve mysteries in real life. Why do people insist on solving them in film? You know, so, and I think that kind of touches on what you were saying there.
Yeah.
And Guillermo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of solving mystery in cinema, I mean, The Changeling, one of the things I did notice when watching it last night is that it does take some shortcuts. I mean, like the ghost can kind of do anything it wants to. So like, you know, in order for this movie to move forward, it has to be able to sort of project directly into John's head what happened, which is kind of silly, except it works in context because it's so horrific of what's happening. But it is one of those things that I think a modern film wouldn't do, it would, but it would be hackneyed. You know, it's, you know, the ghost just sends this one telepathic message one time. Right. And that's very interesting. But, and again, without the direct explanation, it seems kind of out of nowhere. But if you take it within the context of, well, there's a personal connection, the ghost being able to do that with John specifically makes sense. You know, we have a connection between the two of us. But it is, it's just a fascinating little thing that to see how a filmmaker in 1980 was able to sort of pull this off without it becoming, goofy or silly. Like, it seems like a Ryan Turek Blumhouse thing, really. Like, well, okay, the ghost just does a psychic vision. Why? I don't know.
Yeah.
We need it for the plot. We need it for the
story. It would be very flashy. It would be marked by the past would have everything. All would be lots of sepias or greens.
Yeah, sepia tones.
To tint it so that you would know it's in the past, because, you know, the audience might get confused that you're, no, this isn't happening now.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, I'm not a genius, so sometimes you do kind of need to take my hand and lead me along, but not to the extent that a lot of them do.
Yeah. No, that's I'm sure that's coming soon. The Changeling in a three-picture deal.
Directed
by David Gordon Green.
I don't think he's going to be directing anything for a little while. I think
I think he's still dodging. I think he's still dodging William Friedkin's hauntings.
William Friedkin's sending some psychic visions to him, but they're not pleasant.
He said he was going to, and I think he has.
Yeah, William Friedkin's like, I'm going to drown you in a bathtub, David. But I did feel kind of badly, kind of doing a little happy dance when they announced like the next Exorcist movie is probably going to get shut down, and I was like. I'm like, I shouldn't be as happy about this as I am, because that's a bunch of jobs. But
I know it's not on the subject, but I think they are going to make them because they have to.
Yeah,
they're contractually obligated to do it. Also, they spent so much for the movie rights.
They spent so much money on that. Yeah.
But David Gordon Green's not going to do it, so it's going to be something completely different. Now, if it's something that's still a major motion picture, or if it turns out to be a TV show. Or a straight to streaming thing. Who knows?
Yeah.
I don't know what they're going to do. But my assumption he's not involved.
My assumption is it will be direct to Peacock, and you know, you know, they'll have somebody else do it. But yeah.
Right.
But yeah, no, I mean, I joke, but I'm going to knock on wood because I am terrified that Blumhouse will just be like the Changeling part 1, 2, 3, 4.
right. Oh God.
But yeah, the,
the Changeling ends, the Changeling kills.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Blumhouse does a lot of good stuff too. I know a lot of people don't like the studio period, but they do a lot of good stuff. They also do a lot of stuff that we've always seen it when studios kind of get a horror mark on them. You know, there was 20 years ago when Lionsgate was known mainly for horror. You know, right. About 60% of it was shit.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And 20% of it was and the other 20% was really good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there are good. I mean, you guys can both see there's a Megan poster up in my room here, and right. That's Blumhouse, and I actually really like that movie. But
I still haven't seen that.
No, it's fun. But yeah, as far as like the change that goes, I think to your point that you're right. Like, I think that would be the thing. Like the a lot of stuff in The Changeling would be much more, as much as this movie does hold your hand, it would be even worse. Like, right. It's so interesting to me that, and it's a testament to, I think, to how good, George C. Scott and Trish Van Dever are, that there are a lot of expositional scenes throughout the second act of this movie, and it doesn't get boring. Like, you don't get like, Jesus, you guys are still talking about this. Although I do find it very funny that there are scenes that easily could be condensed. They have a conversation that he comes in, sits down. He's like, I found a bunch of information. And then he says, I'm going to go to the Hall of Records and talk to about the real estate and see if I can find a ranch with a right. well. And then he goes and has a scene in which he talks to the guy about finding the ranch and the well. I was like, well, you actually could have just had that all in one scene. You know, you could have rewritten that to be like, all right, so then I looked into it. There is a ranch with a well, and they built a house over it. That's all we need to know.
Right.
But they have a whole scene in which the guy points out, like, well, then in like, you know, 10 years later, they built a barn over it, and then they built a house, and now there's another subdivision. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of information we don't really need. I don't mind. I'm not criticizing right. the film for that, but I do find it funny that as somebody who does value brevity, that I don't mind is something fascinating about this movie. But it is kind of it did make me kind of laugh watching it last night. I was like, wow, we're really going through all of this painstaking research material. Right. Is not something we would do. Now we would never have go to Hall of Records. I mean, you have to pay an actor. See, right. Just that alone. Mm-hmm. Be like, well, there has to be a guy whose one scene is to walk around a table and point at a map. We have to pay that guy actor daily wage, at least. It's just interesting to me that the film would go to those lengths of details. Moving locations, too. That's not something you see very often.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
I was just going to include showing like how meticulous that he has to dig into this thing, which you can believe because, you know, his background in music history, you know, he knows how to dig into this stuff. And that is how you dig into stuff. I mean, I've been to the hall. I've been for projects to Hall of Records and looked at microfiche and looked up old census reports and old everything. And right. it's, you know, I do give them credit though, because they show, and I agree that these could absolutely be condensed. You could have cut the scene and just had it a line of exposition. I think it's interesting that they show like how it's just this boring work that you have to do to dig deeper and deeper and deeper. But the reason you keep doing it is that each time you find out something else, you're like, oh, okay, then we have to follow that string and see where that right. leads, you know? But at the same time, the movie itself does not make it boring. It actually leads you along with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of interesting how they do that because, In real life, it's boring as hell.
It's boring work. But I love that the movie also does take the after all of that, he then says, okay, I gotta go talk to this to Senator Mitch McConnell. And you think like, okay, we're gonna get some like phone calls or something. No, he just drives out to a tarmac and starts shouting at the guy. And I'm like, wait, that you have brevity for? Like, you know, just like smash cut. He's speeding up to this plane, running out, yelling, "Senator, you son of a bitch!" Like it's, you know, and it's like, you know, like after like, three or four calm scenes of him like having quiet conversations about history, and then he's like, "Well, I got to go contact this guy," and it's just drive out there and yell at him. It made me laugh every. It makes me laugh every time, but it's just like this.
It's like the one part of it where you're kind of taken aback by you know the irrational his irrational actions because and later on he says I tried to talk to you at the airport the other day that George I don't think I mean I think if a sitting United States senator had a guy speed up in a car we're a couple of years from when there was an attempt on Gerald Ford's life, you know, you know, Reagan's would be in a couple of years. Yeah, you know, the guy speeds up in a car as a guy's getting on a plane going
with something in his hand that nobody can quite make out. Yeah, like you know, Senator, I have something for you. Like reaching to his pocket. Yeah, I mean. Try doing that in 2024. Yeah.
Right. Little levity in this movie about dead children.
No, it's but yeah, it just makes me laugh every time that it's just like he has these like kind of quiet conversations and it's smash cut to him just driving out onto a tarmac and shouting at the guy. You know, I'm like, there's gotta be a better way to go about that. But at the same time, I mean, I guess that's a way to talk to a senator. I mean, that's probably what I would do. You know, but not quite that way, because then you get shot by Secret Service. But if I ever had a conversation with a senator, it would probably devolve pretty quickly into me becoming George C. Scott and yelling, "You son of a bitch!" Like, but particularly Mitch McConnell, the which I immediately equated to this time around. I was watching it going like, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure Mitch McConnell probably is an orphan that replaced a murdered child. That seems like a Mitch McConnell Mitch McConnell thing, except Mitch McConnell as an orphan probably killed the kid.
Yeah, so McConnell would know about it and be fine with it. Yeah. You know,
his medal is to celebrate absorbing his twin and the world. Yeah, he just has that like I beat him.
I had a second medal made just to commemorate the occasion. Yeah. Right. You know, as somebody completely committed to evil. And as George C. Scott put it, you know, like the worst kind of murder for profit.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, okay, the guy's, you know, Mitch McConnell. You know, but although this guy, it's an interesting question. Let's talk about the senator for a minute. Sam, I'll start with you. So do you think I mean, I know where I want to go with it and what my thought will be on it, but, with the senator here, do you think he gets a raw deal? I guess is the way I'll put it to do brevity here myself. Do you think he deserves what he gets? I mean, what's your thought on him?
Yes and no. I mean, it's obvious that, you know, he hadn't really thought about things that way. And like, you're supposed to feel something for him. But
he seemed to love his father.
He loved his father. And, you know, at the same time, like he knows he was adopted. He knows he wasn't, you know, he's not the original person. I know that he's a fraud in some way, but it's hard to say because they play it kind of ambiguously where you're not sure what he knows and what he doesn't know.
My read on it was that he doesn't remember.
That could be.
I think he knew at one point, but I think maybe he's convinced himself of the lie. What's your take on that, Scott?
I agree. I think, you know, and I was really trying to keep an eye out for it this time when I was watching it, because it has always been an issue. And it's not, it's also a good testament to Melvin Douglas's performance, that I'd actually, this senator, I actually feel a bit sorry for, because by all accounts, it's like, okay, looks like he's, is he underhanded and sleazy? Yeah, he's a politician. That's, they all are. I mean,
Although it
that's how
doesn't
you
matter what side,
survive.
yeah, doesn't matter what side of
That
the aisle you're
like
on, yeah.
everybody has a cop in their back pocket. Yeah. But like he, he's, philanthropic and my words aren't working today. He seems to actually, have dedicated his life to service and stuff, and doesn't seem to be like, he certainly isn't one of these, culture war people that we have, today, that, pins a target on some, persecuted group. But so I think, yeah, I think he was brought along for the ride. But I mean, he was brought along as an orphan in the 19-aughts. What was his power then? What was his choice? He was, I think, 6 years old or something, and sent away. And yes, we'll send you away overseas. I mean, he probably knew something was wrong, but I think, I really like what you said, Sam. I think it's pro I think that he probably did just forget conveniently and convince himself over time. And because he said, and he breaks down and says that my father was a good man, and he's not doing, I don't think he's doing that out of guilt. I think he's very serious. I think he says, like, this man saved my life. He saved me from a life of poverty and destitution and not having a family, and he gave me the opportunity to do this. So honestly, I do feel a bit sorry for him. Is he still guilty? Yes, he's guilty of doing this, but I think that it was something that they did himself. It's one of the things that, I mean, really, the person who deserves all the hatred is the father of him. And you can see that in history. You can see like politicians who had children locked up in mental institutions, and people who disinherited others, and people who were into all sorts of awful business. But there's also, and you don't, that's not the most known thing about them. The most known thing about them was they were the first person to do this. They did this. They were dedicated to this building. They did this. It's something I really give this movie a lot of credit for, because it would be very easy to make this a movie about good guys and bad guys. But there is no getting justice in this movie. The act was done. And the only thing is that this other child who was cruelly murdered was also quickly forgotten, and as if they had never existed. And I think that was just the statement of, I exist, I am here, I'm the person that you are pretending to be. And but it doesn't do it with any moral judgment. So there's a very much a there's it's very ambiguous as to, does anybody really deserve, about who really deserves our and condemnation, if any, in this movie. And I think that's really challenging. It's something where when you're done with it, you're kind of left with it. When he's Melvin Douglas, you'll see him in the end of the film, kind of solemnly, or his figure rather, you'll see it's solemnly marching up the stairs, resignated. And it's there's a sense of, of solemnity into it. It's of mourning, of that, some is that not everybody was guilty, but still, and yet so much pain was inflicted because of this. So, yeah.
But on the other hand, somebody did, fire Claire for renting the house and looking into the past and stuff like that. So somebody knows something is up, and is protecting something.
Oh,
And,
yeah.
you know, it's reasonable to think that the senator is was involved in that.
Yeah.
Being that he's, you know, leads the historical society that, you know,
Sure.
that owns the home. So it's
Sure.
like,
And I'm sure leading this historical society was a calculated move.
Right.
You know,
Yeah.
But it is to protect them. But, you know, there's a lot of cases where, you know, people have a real weird way of compartmentalizing,
right,
you know, in their heads. And I think that that is what the senator was doing. Now, is that right? No.
Right.
But it's also not snidely whiplash type things, you know?
No, I think, I mean, I do think that the senator, I mean,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry.
Oh, no, not at all. But I do think the senator knows, at least knows something, because he definitely is aware, because, I mean, as him pointed out, he does do that. We do have the woman at the Historical Society calls him.
Right.
To tell him, like, by the way, they're looking at your history. George C. Scott does, John does point out, like, you inherited an empire.
Right.
You know, that the senator is protecting. Right. Because the senator knows if this gets out, that empire crumbles.
Right.
You know, that it's back in the day when back in 1980, anyway, truth mattered then. Now it doesn't matter. But, you know, now you can kill a puppy or, you know, kill multiple children and you'll get reelected. But,
right.
You know, I remember the days when, you know, a political career was ended by shouting too loudly at a campaign rally. And now it's, you know, now it's outright threatening people. And they're like, yeah, right. He can be elected. That's fine. You can commit treason and still apparently be on the ballot. But the way I looked at it ultimately was when I thought about that question last night, I was like, okay, so is the senator really, like, is he getting what he deserves? I realized this was the wrong way of looking at it. That's what I thought about, because I was like, well, no, it's not about what he deserves. It's what the real Joseph deserves. And the real Joseph deserves justice,
right?
You know, for what's happened to him. And again, but it, to Scott's point of lack of moral judgment, Joseph is not exactly Casper. You know, Joseph is throwing shit at people. Joseph is murdering cops. You know, Joseph has a body count in this movie.
Right.
You know, the real ghost is also, you know, and to the point where even George C. Scott understands that their relationship only goes so far. You know, that, you know, he has that, it's probably the only real big, I wanted to talk about this too, because one of the things I do feel like the Changeling is missing is a great George C. Scott, like, meltdown.
Right.
There's kind of one, but he does come back. He's like, what do you want from me? Like, I've done everything I can do. Like, and the ghost is like, fuck you.
Right.
Do more, work harder. You know, I will, and I'm going to throw a wheelchair at your girlfriend. Like, get to work. You know, that Joseph is not exactly, even though he's got the most, he's got the crime to be avenged. He's not exactly, you know, turning the other cheek. You know, you can't really necessarily call Joseph a moral figure, the ghost itself. You know, to the point that it seems like John might be more or less safe from Joseph's wrath, but nobody else is. But you could make an argument.
He's safe as long as he's useful.
That's what I was going to say. You could make the argument that as long as he remains useful and compliant, if George C. Scott completely ignored him and said, look, I'm done. I'm just not going to do this anymore. And I'm going to sit here and play the piano. Would Joseph start throwing shit at his head until he started doing it? Yeah, probably. You know, apparently he can set fire to the house if he wants to, with his ghostly powers. He doesn't do that with George, but he could. So, I mean, yeah, it's interesting that, to discuss point that there is no real, doesn't seem to be an awful lot of moral judgment in, other than the exception, the accepting that, Joseph's father is, garbage bag. But and that particularly upsets John. And I should probably find out her character name. Claire.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, wonderful moment, a couple of wonderful moments with Claire. But in particular, that really land the horror of what happened to Joseph, really lands, I think, because of what she's doing.
Right.
She's kind of involved with because of John, because she's falling for John, at least allegedly. That's another thing I do like about the Changeling is that there's no big, there's insinuation of romance. And we get the idea that they are forming a romance, but there are no big moments of, and I think it's something that 2024 we do. There would be a whole scene in which he's like, agonizing over his wife. Instead, they let it be subtle here. You know, that he's out riding a wonderful scene. He's out riding a horse with Claire and he stops and just, and she's like, "What's wrong?" And he's like, "My daughter loved horses." You know, but he's like, "But the what's in what George C. Scott is playing is I forgot about them for a second. I forgot. I'm having a good time with you riding a horse. I forgot about my family, my dead family." And that's if he were to continue down that road, does he become the senator? You know, if you forget the dead, if you forget those who are lost, are you
If he chooses not to feel
feeling
that
alone?
guilt,
Yeah. Well, he I think he reconciles it. You know, yeah. I mean, that's the point is that you can't bury up. You can't bury those you've lost. You can't bury the dead. They stick with you, but you can still move on, but you have to do it in the right way. Otherwise, you're just forgetting them, and that when you forget them, that's when they rise up and attack you.
Which the senator didn't do.
Right. Yeah, the senator did not, and that's really, I think, what Joseph's fighting for. It's not necessarily to kill the senator. It's acknowledge me. I think, as Sam put it, like, you need to, if the senator had, come clean about it and said, "Hey, so I'm, and tried to do right by the real dead child, at least give him a proper burial." Or, something like that, maybe this would never have happened. But it's because of that erasure that Joseph resurfaces. And so the idea that John is like, "Well, I still have to remember my family. I still need to mourn them, but I can move on, but I need to keep them in my heart." And I can move on with Claire and I can have a life. And hopefully he makes good money because Claire got fired. But doesn't blame him, which is nice of her. But
Well, I mean, he obviously makes good money because he can afford to like move across the country and rent, a mansion.
Well, I thought that was more like a gift from the university.
It could be.
But
Well, I mean,
yeah.
and well, he's kind of also well, he's a, yeah, and he's a celebrity at the
My understanding.
university. I mean, you can just see like that. There's about like 10 times the people that are supposed to be in his classroom because
He's
they
just
want to
a
hear him play. They want to hear him to him talk about music history, because in this niche field of classical music, he like you say, he's a
He's a
minor
big deal.
celebrity.
But yeah, it's but yeah, it's a fascinating aspect of and then I think that's why it still remains one of the best haunted house movies, is because the haunted house movie, the ghost story, is usually about memory and about how we handle memory. And so you have this character who's struggling with a memory while being bombarded with somebody else's memory, that happens to reflect his. And I think that that's fantastic. Let's talk about George C. Scott. I just watched Hardcore like last week, and I loved it, for all how bad it actually is, but I still loved it. It has the in my opinion, the greatest George C. Scott freak out moment, which is turn it off, turn it off, turn it off. But I was also thinking in terms of like, you know, that and Exorcist 3. This movie doesn't really have his big flip out moment. Like, it doesn't have a "I believe in you," like, you son of a bitch. Like, you know, he's not, it's not in the file. It's not like, there's not enough George C. Scott yelling in this movie. However, what he does is bring a very subtle performance for such a powerhouse of an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, he's known for, I'm talking in jest, but what George C. Scott is known for is sort of that loud intensity.
Right.
To play a lot of intensity, but play it quiet is, seems to be a little interesting. It's really interesting to see him do this. But what I note every time, and that this is where I'll open it up to you guys, is crying. Right. He has a moment in which he has a dream about his wife and kid being killed, wakes up, he is sobbing in bed, outright sobbing. At a time where I don't think we saw that very much in film or television. Men don't cry in movies. They do a little bit more now, in the last 25, 30 years. But back then, you didn't see that often. So it's interesting to me that George C. Scott, also, I did notice, by the way, that while watching Hardcore and this, George C. Scott has a method in which he cries, which he does the same thing usually. But he has the, let me see if I can remember exactly how it goes. He kind of makes a sob. He covers his eyes.
Right.
And then he covers his mouth. And then he looks up with just his eyes, so you can see the tears. Right. And then he kind of touches his eyebrow, and that's how he does that every time. It's really interesting. He does the exact same things every time. But what's your take on George C. Scott bringing that level, that kind, that much more subdued level of emotionality? And what's your general takes on George C. Scott? I mean, but let's talk about George C. Scott. Sam, what about you? Why don't we start with you?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, one of the cases where of the George C. Scott movies I've seen, he's playing it more vulnerable here than he has a lot of the time. he feels a lot of times watching George C. Scott, like, I'm not sure if he's going to, like, you know, cry or punch me in the face. probably punch me in the face.
While crying.
While crying, right. And here he's, you know, I didn't get that vibe, like, where he's, you know, he's unhinged. He's, you know, he's boiling with anger or emotion. He's just, like, kind of quietly, you know, coming apart. I think this is a good performance of his. I think it's showing a side of him that, you know, maybe he's not as famous for, where he can play it a little softer for the most part. And, you know, he still has his big moments in this. I mean, you know, he's got, you know, "What do you want from me?" You know, "I've done everything I can," you know, and he's got, you know, some big moments. He's got, you know, the scene at the airport.
He does have the airport one too. Yeah.
I mean, but for a lot of it, you know, it's just, we're just watching a man, you know, work his way through grief, and it's pretty great stuff, I think.
Yeah. I love the when he talks to the cop, every time I expect a George C. Scott, like, "Get out of my house," but it's, he doesn't. He just kind of quietly says, like, you know, and the guy's like, "I'll come back with a warrant. I'll be here."
Right.
You know, just quietly going, "Please leave. Please leave my home." And I keep expecting that, you know, that George C. Scott moment. And then it's just sort of, he just quietly just sort of shrugs and says, "Okay, leave my home." Right. It's fantastic. But Scott, what do you think?
George C. Scott's one of my favorites. And I think that he gets a lot of attention for his big, big Patton moments like that. Those big, Patton is, well, Patton, you know, he is, where he, of course, you know, took on this larger than life person and managed to make the person, yes, larger than life, but also someone you could relate to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of his power is, and I think, you know, there's other actors that get that same thing too, like Pacino, for instance. Pacino, and when people talk about Pacino, oh, they think about this, you know. But
yeah,
he's done plenty of subtle things in his acting, filmography, and everything. But you know, George C. Scott, I think, is someone who is possible, capable of being a very gentle and being and also terrifying. He's positive. Mm-hmm. He can be angry and yet very inviting. One of the things I'd use, like, to show, like, one of his probably I think it's probably the most malevolent performance I can think of his, is sticking in the, like, a horror-ish genre, would be in Firestarter.
Yeah.
Where he played Rainbird. He doesn't really, you know, he doesn't do any scenery chewing or anything there or anything like that, but he's very calm and calm and calculated about this absolute psychosis of, you know, cruelty and violence. And that is stunning. Like, there's a part in the movie where he's explaining what his plans are for Charlie, the Drew Barrymore character. And he's explaining it to the head of the shop with Martin Sheen. And, he's very calmly talking about how he is going to befriend this girl and really wants to get to know her, and then he's going to murder her and hopefully absorb her power. And he's doing this in very calm manner that just makes the Sheen character say, "My God, you're insane!"
Yeah, I was gonna say, even the villain, the actual greater scope villain in that movie, is even like, "Holy shit!" Like,
yeah. Like, how are we employing you?
Yeah.
but it's you know, and so, like, the only times you really see George C. Scott freak out in that movie is when that character is pretending to freak out. He pretends to freak out from Vietnam flashbacks, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, but, like, you know, so I think he had a greater range than he often got credit for. And, you know, you'd see that in films like Hardcore, which is a magnificent performance. I have a lot of problems with that movie, but it's a magnificent performance.
Oh, he's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I think he's great. I don't think I've ever seen him in anything that I didn't love him in. I mean, I even loved him on that piece of shit show that he had on the first season of Fox, where he played the president. You look it up.
Okay. I'll have to Google that. Yeah.
Mr. President. It was terrible. He was good. he's somebody who has a great amount of range. And I think that it was and I guess he could be a very volatile person to deal with on set and everything. But I think that he takes such a great care with the characters. He's like one of those actors where it's not like it's not an ego trip. He's taking such care with the characters, and he just becomes that person. And sometimes that means just devouring every bit of air in the room, you know, with a great moment. And sometimes it means and sometimes it just means explain, you know, this, that I am grieving, or that I am trying to build my life anew, or that I am trying to do. You see, even how he deals with people in public, he's always smiling, and you always you're always looking at this, and you're wondering how many of these smiles are real, how many of these smiles, and you do see. You know, and so because he'll be introduced at parties, and he's very, you know, he makes small talk, which I cannot stand making small talk.
Right.
He smiles, and he's very, you know, inviting and everything. But, you know, this is of course, because of the movie, that he is a person that is in great amounts of pain. And then you also see that. And you wonder how much of these smiles are genuine. And you do actually see it. You see it when he's playing the music on the piano, and you see, like, oh, art is one of the things he's using to heal himself with,
right?
Is that he can lean back on his work, which is not, it's not a desk job like a lot of us have. It's not a customer service or 9-to-5 job, but it is art, thank goodness, which actually for his sensibilities, he's able to lean on, and you can see him have pleasant smiles when he's playing. And that's interesting, because you can see that there are those moments that are genuine. But it's always like he has those, but he has that range, you know, that range of being, you know, of going from extremes to just moments of quiet reflection. I love George C. Scott as an actor. I think he's I think he deserves if I had to make a top 10 list of actors, he would absolutely be on it.
Yeah, I think I might agree with that. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I also really love Trish Van Devere, in here. I think that's how it's said. Trish Van Devere. Van Devere. Mm-hmm. I alluded to that earlier, that she does some wonderful work. I watched this movie last night with a friend of mine in the theater after close. Mm-hmm. And every time Trish Van Devere came on the screen, she would just be like, just loving her outfits and hairstyles. but she was pointing out, like, she's like, this woman, and she kept noting things that maybe I wouldn't have thought about, but like how elegant and sophisticated Claire is. And by the way, you know who played that Jean Marsh, who played his wife in the car crash, is Bav Morda from Willow.
And the cop was Baltar, so
I love Trish Van Devere in here, but she does some wonderful work. Like I said, there's the moment where after he gets the vision and he faints, she comes over and she listens to the tape, and she comes out and she's crying. And she actually has way more of a freak out over it than he does. It's selling the horror of that scenario in a way that George C. Scott internalized it. She externalizes. There's some really subtle work there going on about how the way they work together. And why their relationship is working, where he's much more internal, she's much more external. There's a great chemistry between them that shows chemistry between the characters. And I think she's just doing wonderful work. But I mean, and when it comes to big emotional moments, which she has a few in this movie where she kind of freaks out, screams, especially towards the end, the climax, where she's chased out by the wheelchair. She's just losing her mind outside, and she's wonderful at it. But it just noted, it's again one of those things that I can't help but compare it to the modern era, where that performance would easily maybe devolve into camp. But yeah, Sam, talk to me about what you think about Trish Van Devere.
I think she's plays great opposite of George C. Scott. I think she's holds her own, and you know, to do that against, you know, someone of his caliber is really great. I haven't really seen her in much else that I know of offhand. Trying to look to see if there's anything, you know, she might have been in that I've seen, but I don't see anything offhand. She really does play an unusual character in this, because, you know, like we've been alluding to, you know, all the different ways a modern film would screw this movie up. Like, she would be more of a love interest, she would be, you know, more of not that she isn't right now, but she's, you know, much more obvious love interest and more, you know, standard kind of, you know, version of that, where, you know, they have a big scene where they, you know, embrace and kiss and maybe do more. But this, she's playing a little more reserved and, you know, against type, I guess, here. I have no complaints with her performance. It's just solid work all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have much else on her.
Yeah.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. And she's a good, and she's a was a great theatrical actress and everything. Mm-hmm. And her and I actually was just bringing up the credits in case I need to be reminded what they were, because a lot of them are films I've yet to see. But her and George C. Scott actually worked together a lot. They were actually together for a good
She was his wife. Yeah.
And they were like, so apparently they were very committed to each other. They were like soulmates, apparently, from when you hear about their relationship. And, you know, they were in movies like Day of the Dolphin, The Last Run, you know. And she he just had they just and I think it works as soon as she comes up through the chemistry those two have together. And like we've mentioned before, that the film, one of the thing refreshing things the film does is that by the time this film ends, you don't know, are they going to be boyfriend, girlfriend, or are they going to be lovers, or are they just friends? You know, you don't know. It's kept very platonic, very, you know, above board, you know, and because it's a, you know, still a very fresh tragedy. And but she's so instantly relatable. She's so instantly you when she comes in most films, and I think of the even of the era and certainly today. This character would be written as, okay, she's the woman that's going to be in the movie, and she's going to be the love interest, and she's going to be there to help provide exposition, and she's going to do this. And here, no, she seems to be brought along on this because you can immediately relate to her reactions. You can immediately relate to her job, her the way she carries herself, the way she relates to George C. Scott's the John Russell character. You can see how she does that, and they're magical together. I think they're really fantastic, and so and it's a and it's certainly a talent of hers that you know Scott saw on both stage and screen as well. So
I'd kind of forgotten that they were married.
right.
And I believe actually that's how she got the part in this movie, was that he insisted that she be his co-star.
Well, it's a good
They
choice.
worked
I
well
mean,
together.
yeah,
They
they
worked
work
well.
well together.
Yeah, they worked
Yep.
well together. It worked. Yeah, it's great. But no, I mean, to your point, like the both of your points, that the way this relationship is developed, is that it's a developing relationship,
Yeah.
which is not something we see very often in these films. Usually by the end of the picture,
They're
they're
together, and that's it.
together.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a kiss. There's a like I said, there, like I said earlier, there would be a scene in which, you know, they have a big emotional outburst about like moving on from his wife and kid and starting
Right.
something new, and like that would all be a big second act moment. But as Scott pointed out, you know, at the end of the movie, we don't really know if there's an actual relationship, romantic relationship that's going to come from this. We can assume so. You
Right.
know, she's literally, you know, for a friendship, she's going pretty far. You know, for without for a platonic relationship, she's, you know, dealing with, you know, a ghost
Right.
throwing things at her. So it's a lot to go through for a friend, but the idea is that she's also playing this level of patience and empathy, without calling attention to it. You know, there is no moment in which she's telling him, "I'm being patient." You know,
Right.
she's not bringing up his wife and kid. She's letting him come to her with that. You know, if he wants to bring it up, she'll listen, but she's not bringing it up. She's not pushing him to move anywhere and move in any direction that he doesn't want to. There's a lot of emotional intelligence, I think, both on page and on screen, that this film is bringing to the table, that I think we don't see very often, throughout film history.
Right.
The idea of, nowadays we talk about a lot on, you know, on social media, and everybody talks about boundaries and all these, I guess you could call them, you know, buzzwords or what have you. The way we talk about human relationships has changed, and hopefully for the better. But for a movie made in 1980 to have a relationship that is forming, without telegraphing anything, I think is something special.
Right.
And it's something that I really resonated with, particularly last night, just thinking about, you know, the only moment I think we really have in which we can cl clearly see a romantic relationship is she's trying to call John. John's talking to the senator, and
Right.
he's not answering, but she eventually is like, she just goes to the house,
Yeah.
knowing something's wrong. She still goes to try and help him. that's the moment I think that we know that she's serious about him. She's been playing along the whole time, but that's the moment where I think she's coming to his rescue. But she's playing this some wonderfully what's the word I'm thinking of? Subtle moments, but she's also doing the big stuff well, and she's doing a lot of heavy lifting, I think. The scene in which they're talking and then she stops and stares off to the left of frame is wonderful. And I remember the young lady that was watching the movie with me last night, Laura, she actually gasped and was like, "Don't show the stairs. I don't want to see what's on the stairs.
Right.
I don't want to see what's on the stairs." And then she said, "Oh, it's just a wheelchair." Right. I guess that's okay. But she was expecting a ghost, you know, right. like to appear and scare her. Because the way Trish Van Devere plays that moment of seeing something on the stairs that he can't see. So he comes forward in frame.
Right.
And she sees it. It's one thing I do want to talk about, one more thing, because even though this is an actress piece, I think, in many, many ways, I do want to talk about the cinematography in this movie and Peter right. Medak's direction.
Yes.
We had talked a little bit about earlier about exposition being, we've talked, Sam and I've talked about this many times, about how the challenge of exposition in general in film is something that we always tend to key in on because it's such a difficult thing to do well. Right. It's the fastest way to bore your audience is have characters talk about things, you know, in an expositional way and explaining things to the audience. Your audience will lose interest. A good expositional character is able to do something both on the page and on screen that will keep you interested. And this movie does that. Scott, I guess we'll start with you this time. So talk to me about what your thoughts on Peter Medak's direction and the cinematography and the way this movie is presented.
Peter Medak, well, one of the things he does that is so interesting in this film is that very early on, you'll see him use these very unnatural angles. He'll do a lot of overhead shots as if to show the George C. Scott character, John Russell, is being watched by, you know, is being, you know, observed by spirits and stuff like that. You'll see overhead shots. You'll see a lot of tracking shots that aren't right on top of the people. Like usually if a camera follows somebody, you know, across a room or into a room, they're following, like, and you're right there, like as if you're walking right alongside them. This one, it actually is tracking at like almost like a respectful distance. And what that does is it creates this, you know, it creates kind of like this surreal moment where you have a real consciousness of that there's something else present in the frame. And it's one of the very subtle ways he uses to do this. And then, of course, later on, he uses these, I think he must have used these, some kind of special lens or something to do these things where there's like moments that are just in perfect, where the figure is just in perfect focus. And then there's something else that's not in focus. And then there's something else that's in perfect focus in the background. And it's often where they're doing a lot of the investigating with the tapes and everything. He has lots of these really artistic touches, but they're not super showy. This is not, you know, and Peter, you know, and he can do things that are, you know, out there and really graphic even, you know. In the 90s, one of the better movies he made in the 90s are The Craze and Romeo is Bleeding. One of the worst is Species 2, maybe.
Yeah.
That's personal opinion. But, yep. I guess before this, he had also had some, you know, crazier productions and stuff. But like he creates this without being really imposing the style on it. He's very conscious of exactly the right level to reach, so that he, as a director, is not just shooting actors. It's actually telling the story and it's actually helping convey the story, but it's done at such a respectful distance that it is not overpowering the story. I mean, you're not seeing what you would, again, to go back to what we were saying before, a lot of the Blumhouse things, where it would really be underlined with a lot of punctuated music and like a lot of, you know, quick, jump scares and everything like that. He really manages to, I hate to be cliched about this, but I did have this in my notes when I was doing notes, which I didn't bring with me. But I hate to be cliched, but like, you know, the character John Russell is a composer, and this is the movie plays like a classical composition, and it brings us along with it. It has these big highs and big lows, and it leads us along note by note by note by note. And it doesn't overpower us at any moment. It doesn't take us out of the story. It doesn't take it. He really has a knack of just bringing us right along with him. And he does that with some just beautiful camera work and focus work in the film. So,
right.
So all of that was exceptionally well said.
Yes.
Yeah.
Could have fooled me, but thank you.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't think I don't think we would have been able to say it with as much passion, I think, as you just did. I mean, but yeah, no, it's an exceptionally well-made movie. You know, Sam, do you have anything to add to that? I mean,
just that, you know, this is another guy who works equally in film and TV. And those are two vastly different mediums with, you know, different challenges on each. You know, on TV, you have to be able to get the shot time after time after time under a short, you know, such a short length of time and such a short budget. Even nowadays, when, you know, TV episodes cost, you know, in the millions of dollars a piece, there's still like nothing like a movie costs. So I think he's a very disciplined director. He knows what he's doing. And, you know, like Scott said, like everything I've seen him do, except for Cypher Species 2, which I had written down as well, because I'm like, oh, this fucking movie.
And that thing sticks out like a sore thumb in his filmography.
Not few movies can lay claim to, you know, to not being as good as Species 1.
Yeah.
And that's saying a lot. I think his direction in that is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just, it's this terrible movie. But all of his movies, like, you know, that I've seen and TV shows that I've seen, like, he puts the art form second to telling the story. And that's I think, a sign of a really solid director.
Yeah, it would definitely be. It's very easy. I mean, like you said, if it's splitting time between film and television, I mean, it's really easy to become a work for hire director that just sort of phones it in. You know, the working man director, the professional director, and to lose sight of artistic composition. But Medak in this picture is, in fact, the young lady that was in the theater noticed, you know, a couple times he switches to handheld.
Right.
She did point that out. She's like, oh, that's the ghost looking. And I'm like, yes, very good. But it's something that, you know, subconsciously, I don't think I would have necessarily noticed right away, you know, that there is this, there are moments, as Scott pointed out, where the cinematography is clearly from the point of view of a ghost. You know, the camera is not just a casual observer. It is a character who is.
And it even predates him moving in. So it's not necessarily always Joseph. Either. So.
Yeah. Someone's observing. But who else could be observing from beyond? But yeah, I mean, it's just an exceptionally well shot film. I like the setting a lot too. I like the house. Like I said earlier at the beginning, it's interesting to me that the house is never a home. It doesn't have that feel of. I think he only takes a couple of items with him. They point out he has the one, like the secretary that he has the ball in.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But other than that, he's largely seems to be like he's taking what appears to basically be a small apartment, bringing that stuff into a mansion. And he's so out of place in that mansion in the film, the way the film shoots it as this big cavernous space that never, the only time we ever get intimate with the camera is when he's crying. Really, when he's having a bad day, where he, but other than that, it's usually him within these large spaces that he's not, you know, comfortable in. But like Laura, when I was watching with her, was also like when he was going upstairs and looking in, you know, in these old hallways, she's like, she was noting how anxious it was become making her, because it looks terrible up there.
Right.
It doesn't look like a nice place to wander around. And I'm like, exactly. This house is not his home.
Right.
And so when he goes upstairs into these dark old hallways, they are foreboding. They are, they're scary places. They're thing places he doesn't want to be. And, you know, he walks in and he finds this hidden door. And if she didn't quip pretty quickly, she's like, okay, that I'd do.
Right.
And I'm like, oh yeah, me too. If I found a secret door, I would be opening that thing. Like,
yeah,
I would be,
sure.
What's in there? However, I think as soon as I found the creepy attic with a child's wheelchair, I'd be out pretty
right.
quickly, which he does. She loved that scene too, where he walks in, he sees the goat, he sees Joseph in the tub, and he just backs out of the room. It made her laugh.
Right.
But I was like, no, it's he's kind of in shock, and he just sort of
that is
backs
how I would
away.
react.
Yeah, back away. Well, I'd run. I'd be like, you know, I've talked about this many times. When Sam and I have talked about movies with ghosts in it, I'm like, I find ghosts fascinating, and I don't believe in ghosts.
Right.
But I saw one, I'd be in the next state. Like,
right.
it would be like, I, you know, people are like, oh, I want to see a ghost. I'm like, I don't. That sounds scary. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see, you know, but.
Any kind of experience I had when I was younger that may or may not be something that was considered kind of unnatural like that, that was how I reacted. It's just that moment of shock and just kind of slowly backing off.
Yeah.
And, you know, because you're still trying to, because, you know, you're, don't, I don't, you don't have a fight or flight reference. You're just, you're trying to, it was trying to make sense of something that doesn't make sense, you
right.
know? And in addition to scaring the shit out of you. So when I saw, when I noted that this time, when he like backs off, I'm like, I noticed, I said, you know, I'll bet you some folks would find that funny. And honestly, that's how I would react.
Yeah.
I would slow, it's how it, my eyes would go wide. I'd back off very slowly and just kind of go down the stairs as I tried to make sense of what the hell I just saw.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that what's interesting about the way that shot too, the of Joseph in the bathtub, is without the context, without the frame of reference, we don't exactly know what we're looking at. It's such a surreal image. You know, it looks kind of like, you know, Jason Voorhees in the first Friday the 13th movie. Like, there's like, his face is distorted. We're not really sure what it is we're looking at. It's very unsettling. And we don't exactly know, you know, and so it creates this aspect of that. Once he goes upstairs, at any given point, really, the landscape becomes alien. It becomes unfamiliar. It's not appointed up there either. There's these bare hallways up there,
right,
with very little light too. The Changeling plays with light very well. And even though most of its scenes take place in the day, in fact, I love, by the way, the seance scene takes place during the day. They just close the window shades and they're in the dark. The house is big enough and has this internal room that they can actually shut out the sunlight in this room. But when they're done, he pulls open the curtains, there's sunlight shining in, and that's extraordinary too. There's no dark and stormy nights in this movie. There are no, you know, those cliches aren't there. This is not the crumbling old Gothic manor. It's actually well appointed. It's a nice place. Right. But if you go upstairs, it's suddenly it's hell. But I mean, it's, but I love the idea that, you know, in particular, the after the seance scene, he uses a lot of wide angles from up above. But when he's also on listening to the recording, it's a lot of the same. It's, you know, this big ass room, which, by the way, has like framed areas that look like they're supposed to be for paintings. But there's just basically like wallpaper in there.
Right.
Like, it's really weird looking. It's interesting. I think it's supposed to be a tapestry.
It's not a home.
But yeah.
It's not a home. And I wouldn't know what to do with all that space. And probably the only thing I would do differently than what he does is that I would be turning lights on in every damn room,
Right.
you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would deal with the banging and I would deal with all that. I'd be like, well, that's weird. But then the only thing, what I would do differently is that as soon as I saw the kid in the bathtub, I'd probably fall down the stairs, break a hip, and go to the
Right.
hospital. And
Yeah.
that's where I'd sit out the rest of the movie. So sorry, Joseph, but
I
I'm too
certainly
much
wouldn't
of a
go back.
coward to
Yeah.
confront the senator for
Yeah,
you. But
I wouldn't come back. Yeah.
yeah, I'm too much of a coward to help you with the senator, Joseph. But yeah, it's let's make that our last topic then. So let's talk about scary, because I think the changeling's pretty scary.
Yeah.
But Sam, let's start with you. What's the scariest bit in this movie for you? What scenes? What stands out to you as scary in the Changeling?
As far as unnerving, I think the first scene where the ball comes down the stairs is right up there with the best. I mean, it's just done so well and so understated that it's just like, oh, it gives you chills. I also think the seance scene is really effective, in a more bombastic way, but it's
There's
really,
great rhythm in that scene.
yeah,
Yeah.
it's shot just so well and put together so well that, like you said, it's got a rhythm to it. It doesn't let up. It's just, you know, oppressive, and it's easy for those kind of scenes to get silly. I mean, you know, because seances are really silly.
Silly.
They, yeah,
Well, speaking of
especially.
silly, I mean, I love that before that, there's a random scene in which he talks to a guy in psychic research.
Right.
For one scene where he's like, oh yeah, there are a couple of real mediums. I'll set you up with one. That's
Right.
it. That's how we
Yeah.
get a medium. We didn't need that scene. We could have just had a medium show up and been like, yeah,
Right.
whatever. But no, please continue.
You know, so I think those two scenes are really effective, and the finale, I think, is also an all-timer. Because a lot of haunted house stories have a hard time with the finale. It doesn't seem to, you know, they never seem to be know what to do with themselves for the big closing, you know, to have the culmination of a haunting, you know, be not over the top or not, you know, goofy or whatever. And I think this one plays right along that line of being, you know, really effective closing.
Yeah, you can't treat a haunted house movie the way you would treat, a monster movie. Like
Right.
you can't punch the ghost out at the end of the movie. I
Yeah.
suppose you can, depending, if you're like, in House on the Hill or whatever, I suppose you can.
Right.
But
Like even like, you know, we did like Amityville Horror, which isn't, you know, a great was isn't a great movie,
right.
but it has some good scares in it and stuff like that. But like they're, you know, the culmination of that haunting where, you know, they finally going up to leave the house doesn't feel like a culmination. It's just everything's louder that day. You know, it's just
Right.
there's nothing, you know, big that happened in the closing of that movie that would be like, okay, this is too much. We're about to die, you know. Except
Totally.
once again they go back for the dog. Hooray for them.
That's still my favorite thing about that movie,
Yep.
the go back for the dog. But no, I think you're absolutely right. I think that ghost story endings are very difficult to come by, because either you have a non-ending,
Right.
which is a lot of them, I think, or you struggle with some sort of climactic showdown.
Right.
Because like I said, you can't really you unless you're Pete, unless you're Pete Venkman, you can't bust a ghost.
Right.
There's you could have an exorcism or whatever, but that doesn't work in films. You don't
Right.
actually funny funny story, exorcism and exorcist doesn't work. It's so, I mean, yeah, you do have a struggle. But also in terms of maintaining the character of the ghost, is something that a lot of films challenge struggle with.
Right.
And the Changeling, I mean, the entire climax is it seems like Joseph's trying to hurt Trish, not Trish, Trish Van Devere is her name, but the character is Claire. But it's actually he's trying to get her out of the house.
Right.
Same thing when John comes in and the wind is going and there's fire and all this stuff. It's just trying to keep John out. It's like, no one, but this is my end game. I don't actually want you to get hurt. You've been helpful. like it looks all it's very violent, but it's at the same time, it's like it's just saying, get out.
Yeah.
Both of you don't have a part to play in this anymore. The fact that that is being played out metaphorically through physical action is, I think, part of the strength that this movie has. Right. You know, but yeah, so I mean, I agree with you for sure. This is, I think, as in terms of finishing off a ghost story, The Changeling is one of the best, if not the best, climaxes in ghost story history, I think. But Scott, what about you? What's scary?
I'll go back to that. I mean, first of all, you know, when we hear talk about scary, you know, if you've seen a lot of horror movies, you hear the complaint all the time. Well, yeah, but nothing really scares me anymore. You know, you right. hear about, you know, I've said it, you know, lots of my friends have said it, you know, and yeah, it's true. You know, once you've seen, you know, so many things, you know, you kind of get to know the rhythms, you get to know the beats, and you just have fun with those rhythms and beats, but you don't necessarily get scared the way a casual viewer would. The Changeling is genuinely scary, just like Robert Wise's The Haunting, which I think, as I said, is probably the only ghost story that I like more than this. Is that the Changeling is genuinely scary. And I was watching it again last night. I don't know how many times I've seen this. This had to be like 7 or 8
for me.
And I plugged in the Blu-ray last night and I was watching it, and I was like, and the ball goes down there, and every time something happens, I can't count how many times I just went, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, I mean, it's just, it really creeps up on you, this movie. And it has, and most of it are these small moments that creep up on you. Hearing the voice on the tape and, you know, reacting along with George C. Scott and stuff like that. But I want to go back to that seance scene. The editing is so great in that scene.
Yeah.
Whether showing all the yes, no, you know, on the paper or as they're scribbling along. And Sam, thank you for mentioning it, because yes, almost every seance scene you see in a movie is so corny because mediums aren't real. Yeah. At least from my experience, they aren't real. I'm very much in the Houdini camp here, where they are not real.
I think we all are. Yeah.
And they're kind of charlatans, but so they all kind of play kooky, and some of them, you know, you can kind of lean on that kookiness and it works, like in Witchboard. If you see Kevin Tenney's Witchboard, they lean on the kookiness of the idea of a medium in that, and it works. Right. And in this one, no, it's just, you know, he went to a scientific research thing. It's true, it says psychic research, but he went to one. They said 99.9% of them are fake.
Yeah,
a couple of them that come in, and they do this thing, and it is, and you always expect to like see like, oh, where they're faking it at first and then it comes real or something like that.
Right.
No, it just starts right away. He's the ghost in this movie isn't playing, you know, hide and seek. They're right there and present the whole time, which really works for the entire film. And you see that in that seance scene, which, unlike so much of the rest of the film, is just this hectic and moment that just escalates and escalates and escalates until crash. And it's just a wonderful moment, really well shot, really well edited. And considering that almost the entire thing is just dealing with people's reactions around a table.
Right. Yeah.
In basically turning every single character into as passive an observer as us. I think that's a hell of an achievement to actually make such a often hackneyed sequence really work. So that's probably my favorite sequence of it, but the film is just chilling all the way through.
I agree. Yeah. I love that medium is no nonsense. Like there's just no bullshit with that character. She's barely the character, but we get a lot from her just from the actress just performing. Like she goes upstairs, looks up into the secret door attic, comes back down, sits down and just starts working. And then when it's over, shakes his hand, takes her money, goes home. You know, God bless you. No nonsense medium.
Thanks for a weird afternoon.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, no bullshit, no, but yeah, I mean, for my money, it's still, I mean, obviously the ball scene is a justifiably famous, you know, the way that comes down, and then he takes it out, takes the ball out, throws it in the river, comes back, ball comes back down. And he has a wonderful speak. Again, he just has a wonderful reaction, which is he just sort of looks at it, puts his hand over his mouth, like, oh my God. And then we cut to the next scene.
Right.
You know, I'd probably piss myself. But for my money, I think still the murder sequence has got to be one of the most genuinely unsettling murder sequences I've seen in a film.
Oh yeah.
You know, with the kid's voice sort of doing that, not narration, but just repeating a single word, you know, monosyllabic, you know, father, my metal, boom. Mm-hmm. And then you see
doesn't
a guy
sound
walk
like a
up.
Child doesn't sound like a child at all.
No.
It sounds
like a ghost.
Yeah, it sounds like a ghost. It sounds like some adult doing a child's voice, like a spooky child's voice, you know. And it's but this time it works because it's with this such a savage crime.
Yeah. And it's but it's so savage, and not in that it's not savage. It's not even explicit, really. It's like he just pulls this kid up. And the kid's an invalid, so he can't get away. He's drowning. It's horrific. And then, you know, the banging, you know, it's genuinely upsetting. And it's for my money, it's what sets the tone for the whole film from there on out is, and it's why we can accept John's dedication, because we look at that and either you're some kind of a monster or you want this ghost to win, you know? And so we support John in this endeavor, but that scene is just, everything about it is just so exceptionally well done. To your point, Scott, about also, like, you know, sepia tones and everything like that, that he does, kind of like, uses some softer lighting, I think, during that murder sequence. So it's a little softer,
right,
in that scene. So we do get some visual acuity that it's you know, visual evidence that it's the past, but we also it also underscores how horrible the crime is. You know, the past is not something that we can just that is. I think it was Faulkner called it the rose-colored glasses. Everybody looks back with rose-colored glasses at the past. I think it was Faulkner. It might have been Steinbeck, but this is sort of saying, like, you can look back at it through that, you know, through the fuzzy memory thing and be like, oh, it's nice looking, and it's horrible.
Right.
Like, you know, whatever happened, and it was horrible, whether, no matter how you look at it. And it's just an extraordinary sequence. I every time I'm just completely shocked by it. What do you guys make of the title? This one, I promised this was going to be our last one, but I have one more thing, because it was something that I remembered I mentioned to Sam before we started recording, that my friend Laura, when she was watching the movie, she didn't understand the title. And she's like, so what's, because in the movie, she's like, so what is changing? Who is changing? Who is the changeling? And then finally, there's just one line of dialogue in which he's, you know, John points out that, you know, says, this other child, the changeling. And she's like, oh, that's what it means. And I was like, yeah, it's from Celtic myth. I think it's Celtic, or the Fae is Celtic, right?
Yeah.
Am I right about that? Or am I, you know, having a stroke? Okay. But yeah, that the idea of a changeling, we've seen in films since, oddly enough, it took a long time for us to have a film with an actual changeling. But where they're a form of Fae that steal babies and then replace them and then eat the parents later on. And then eat the baby too. But because the fairies are not Tinkerbell, they're actually horrible, monstrous creatures that tear people apart. But yeah, it's interesting to me that the title is not extrapolated on in this film. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
The first time I watched this film, the whole film went over my head. I was a kid. The title was no exception to that. So yeah, I can see why it might not be the most approachable title in the world, but I think it fits. I think it's a good, clever title that, once you know
Yeah.
what it is, describes the film very well. And it and it but in a way that doesn't really give away the twist. I mean,
Right.
because I guess I mean it is a twist that, this senator is the replacement for this kid. I mean, it's not something that, you would normally think of. So I think it
And a
works.
malevolent one, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Scott, do you have any takes on that, on the title? Do you think it should have been named something else, or?
No. I think that it was I was not aware of the Celtic connections that you cited there. I think it's a very old term and not often used, but I think it works in ways like, say, like a title like The Wicker Man works. When you tell, go back to a better time before the Nicolas Cage film
Right. Nah, I love the Nicolas
existed.
Cage film, all right. But yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it's still terrible, but I love it.
I don't like Neil. I don't like Neil LaBute, but anyway, like go back, but like if you go back and say The Wicker Man to somebody that didn't know what The Wicker Man was, like I didn't when I saw the movie 20, 25 years ago, or whatever it was, then oh yeah, that oh that's what it means. That's the surprise. There, the changeling. That I mean. It's when you hear the changeling and it's a ghost story, you think, ooh, it is something. It's going to be a changeling is something supernatural, and a changeling is mysterious, and it's going to be this creature. No, that's really all what the term means. It means a kid that's been substituted, and it's weird that it's weird that it. That there's an actual term for that, by the way, but it's an old term, and I think that there was a film that Eastwood directed a while, like about 10 or 15 years ago, that was called that, and that dealt with similar stuff. But again, it's not an often used term, and so when you approach this movie, The Changeling, you don't know what it is, and at the end, you're like, oh, and but yeah, in actual, that is a very literal definition of what the word means. Is it's just a substitution. But why was there the substitution stuff? There's still so much mystery surrounding the term, whether you know it or not, because we don't use the term anymore.
No, not really.
So there's still so much mystery around it. Even that even if you do know, you're wondering. Why, how, all this stuff, and how does this play into the story? It's and they kind of tell you what happened early on
Yeah,
with the film. The
they
rest
figure it out.
is just kind of trying to get all the pieces to fit. That I no, I think The Changeling is actually quite a good title because it does draw the it can draw both casual viewers and and more seasoned horror viewers in with a different hook, kind of, and so I know I like the title quite a lot. I think it works.
It just occurred to me that both Josephs are changelings, and that's fascinating to me. That the senator is the changeling of the original, but the ghost is the changeling for John's daughter, and my mind is blown. So, yeah, that just occurred to me. So, but yeah, in terms of just the general term of a child substituted for another, holy shit. So
It's what's happening. He can't do anything to save. He can't do anything to bring to give closure to his own child, but he can do this,
Yeah. All right, my mind is blown. Holy shit. All right, Sam, you want to take us out? Do we have
Scott,
any
thank you.
last thoughts or anything? No.
No, I think I'm good. Scott, do you
You're
have anything
good.
else?
No, I think I've talked everybody zero.
That's why
So
we
I'm
have you
good.
on.
That's why we have guests, yeah.
called added value, lazy. My friend. Yep.
Yeah, we're lazy. We like it when the we would like it when the guests do all the talking. So.
Oh no! I hope I didn't do all. No, I hope I didn't do that.
I'm kidding. You're always a great guest. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You have anything you want to plug or anything like that?
Like I said, I've you can still catch my old stuff on Moviocrity.com.
Mm-hmm.
My old web series, Moviocrity. A lot of the episodes are still on YouTube. All of them are on Vimeo. Otherwise, you can look me up. You know, Scott Davis. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Threads. I'm on Instagram. Mm-hmm. You can look me up at all those places that aren't owned by Elon Musk. Right. Hopefully, you know, and I don't say too much because I've been saying it for years because it's been a little slower going than was expected, but I do hope to get something going again sometime soon.
I hope you do because your old stuff on Moviocrity is great.
Oh, thank you.
Yep. So with that, thank you once again for taking the time with us. It's always wonderful to have you.
Yep, same.
To our listeners, all six of you. Thank you very much for taking the time to spend with us. Hope you're doing well. Just want to remind you to keep it positive and keep it productive. Watch out for each other. And as always, I like to say be kind, rewind, but mostly be kind. Thanks.